Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. As today we talk about some of the most recent data sets in chronic lymphocytic leukemia. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Jennifer Brown from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, and Dr. Debbie Stevens from the Huntsman Cancer Institute at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by our faculty, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As we always do, we put out a short one-minute survey for you to take at the beginning and the end of this program. If you can take that survey, you'll get a lot more out of the meeting. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars, and if you're into audio programs, check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a recent program on CLL with Dr. Hillman. We're doing a whole bunch of these year-in-review programs. We did one last night on breast cancer. Next week, we'll be doing one on Tuesday on multiple myeloma. And then on Wednesday, targeted therapy of non-small cell lung cancer. So much going on there. The next week after that, we'll be heading out to San Francisco for the GI Symposium. We'll be doing three CME meetings out there, and all three of them will be put online for those of you who are not at the meeting to watch live, or we'll be sending out on replay. Wednesday the 18th, we'll be talking about colorectal cancer. Then on the next day, gastroesophageal cancers. And then finally on Friday the 20th, we'll be talking about hepatobiliary cancers. And then the following week, we'll be doing a program on gynecologic oncology. But today we're here to talk about CLL. It seems like the amount of new information that's exciting just continues to come out in CLL. And as we do in this series in general, I met with both of the faculty prior to this meeting over the last couple weeks to record an in-depth presentation. Jennifer went through new data sets, of course, particularly a lot of things from ASH and first-line therapy. And then Debbie went into the issue of relapse disease, but also new and exciting strategies. Here's where we're heading in terms of what we're going to be talking about. First, we'll begin talking about CLL treatment, first line treatment of CLL, some new data on venetoclax, but also a bunch of new things on BTK inhibitors. Of course, we'll get into the phase 3 Alpine study, late breaking abstract presented at ASH by Jennifer, looking at zanubrutinib first line. That's going to be a very interesting part of this discussion today. Then we'll get into the exciting area of combining BTK with venetoclax. Then we'll get into non-covalent BTK, specifically pirtobrutinib, CAR-T. Richter's transformation is going to be a pretty interesting topic today. A couple of things came out at ASH that I certainly found interesting, so hang on for that as well. We're going to start out talking about first-line therapy. And Jennifer, you started out reviewing some of the new data sets or follow-up data on venetoclax, beginning with the CLL14 study. Can you just kind of go back over what that study looked at? You know, we don't use a lot of slides here. This is really a podcast. We want to just talk about it, what the study looked at, and what we've seen now with more follow-up from the study.
Sure. The CLL14 study enrolled treatment-naive older patients with CLL with comorbidities and randomized them between venetoclax, obinutuzumab, or obinutuzumab chlorambucil. The median follow-up is now over 5 years, and the five-year PFS is about 73%. In the patients with the mutated favorable IGVH in particular, we see that many of them are still having ongoing durable responses, whereas the unmutated IGVH patients have reached a median PFS at about 5 years. We also know that the depth of remission is strongly associated with progression-free survival. And in the update we heard this past year, it's also now associated with overall survival. And so this is a highly effective regimen. It allows patients to only get 1 year of therapy and then be off therapy in remission for potentially extended periods of time. And there's also the potential to retreat patients at time of relapse, but we have pretty limited data on that still.
So, Debbie, what's your approach to retreating with venetoclax? When are the situations where you think about doing that? And what's been your experience when you have done it?
Well, there's, you know, certainly as we'll talk about today, just really a lot of options for patients with CLL right now. And so it's not often that I do consider retreatment with venetoclax. But the situations where I think it's most most useful are when patients have had a longer response to their initial treatment with venetoclax. And, you know, I think longer is probably about a year, but I don't have clear data to support what does long mean. So maybe it's a little bit shorter than that. Maybe it's a little bit longer than that. But if somebody's had a response for at least a year, and that, you know, maybe they're not a clinical trial candidate for some other reason, I think those are people who it's reasonable to consider retreatment at that point.
So, Jennifer, one of the other studies that you cover related to venetoclax in your talk was the CLL13 study. This is in younger, fit patients. Before we get into this study, I'm curious where you see things heading. You know, a lot of the CLL studies that, you know, were really treating patients based on did divide based on older and younger patients. Moving forward, is that going to continue to be the approach to designing trials, or do you see maybe it coming more together?
Well, it certainly has been coming more together. But for example, with ibrutinib, we see actually a very marked difference in toxicity based on age. The older patients are much more likely to have significant complications. And so I think it is important that we continue to evaluate age and comorbidity as a parameter and not completely avoid it. It could potentially be incorporated within one trial rather than having entirely separate trials, probably, with most of the studies that we're doing now, though.
Yeah, so that is true. Also, you know, in terms of the approach to these patients, Debbie, another issue that comes out is whether to treat or not, whether to actually start treatment. Before we get into this CLL13 study, any comments? I don't know that we've seen a lot of data on the treatment of high-risk patients who do not meet the typical criteria for treatment, Debbie. And there is a trial looking at treating patients versus what we do now, observing them. Are there situations right now, is your approach to treating versus not treating the same? Or as we move more into the era of novel agents, are there situations where you would consider treating, you know, del-17p patient, for example, who doesn't meet criteria to treat?
Outside of a clinical trial, I really still fairly closely follow the IWCLL guidelines, so waiting for symptoms or cytopenias. Of course, this is really a big area of interest for me because I lead the SWOG study that's looking at the high-risk patient population and looking at early intervention of venetoclax and obinutuzumab versus early versus delayed therapy, so kind of as we do standard of care right now. And how we chose the high-risk group for that, these are patients with a CLL IPI score of 4 or higher. And so patients, you can get a score of 4 just by having deletion 17P or a TP53 mutation. And so those patients are included. Or you can have a combination of unmutated IgHV, high beta 2 microglobulin, higher RISE stage, or older age. And so those patients, we also include patients with a complex karyotype as high risk. And so, you know, I think it will take us a while to figure this out because what we're trying to establish is if this early treatment can improve overall survival. And the good news for CLL patients is most of them have quite a long survival anyway. And I think that that's really going to be the only thing that's going to move the needle. Now, of course, you know, there's a study that's ongoing through the German CLL group that looks at early treatment with ibrutinib also. I feel like that really has not picked up much steam just because of the toxicities of ibrutinib and the fact that it's a, you know, long-term therapy. So, you know, I think a shorter therapy like venetoclax and obinutuzumab, giving it for a year, is a little bit more appropriate in this setting. At least now with the data we currently have available.
So Jennifer, let's talk a little bit about the CLL13 study again in younger patients. Really fascinating study. Can you talk a little bit about what they looked at, what the endpoint was, in particular being MRD, which I think is really interesting, what they've seen and what you think it means.
Sure. So the COL13 study is also a study done by the Germans in which younger fit patients were randomized between chemoimmunotherapy, which was FCR for patients under 65 and BR for patients over 65, to venetoclax rituximab, venetoclax obinutuzumab, or venetoclax obinutuzumab with ibrutinib. So it was a four-arm study, and it had co-primary endpoints. The first was rates of undetectable MRD, and that was reported a year ago at ASH. And the second was progression-free survival. And so what was really striking about these data is that the two obinutuzumab-containing arms were really much better than the other two arms. The venetoclax rituximab and chemoimmunotherapy were pretty similar, whereas the ven-obin and the ven-obin with ibrutinib were pretty similar to each other, both in the very high rates of undetectable MRD up in the 80% and the best progression-free survival, which was at 3 years, 88 to 91% in both the ven-obin and the ibrutinib ven-obin. I think another key point is that the ibrutinib didn't really add much in terms of the rate of undetectable MRD or the progression-free survival, but it did add toxicity. There were cardiac toxicities and other toxicities as well. And so these data support using ven-obin in patients, younger fit patients, so now patients of any age, we have good data for ven-obin, and don't provide much support for adding ibrutinib in that context.
I thought it was interesting that they had FCR in the younger patients and, it, you know, time-limited therapy, if you think about it. Do you still use, I know it wasn't that long ago that you were telling me you were still using FCR in some situations, Jennifer. Are you still using it? What did they see here? It kind of looked like even in the mutated patients that the ven-obin was, it seemed similar to what you saw with FCR.
Right. Well, so the reason I have continued to use FCRs because I do believe it's a curative regimen and particularly beneficial to the very young fit patients. You know, the pandemic has really cut out my use of FCR. Although, you know, now that we're getting a little bit beyond the pandemic, I will offer it potentially to appropriate patients, although we give it with a BTK inhibitor the way we did in our trial, which has very high rates of undetectable MRD. But the other thing that's going on is patients really don't want chemotherapy. So patients don't choose it. And, you know, in terms of the data, I think that, as I mentioned there, so if you subset only to the young patients, the FCR actually has as good or slightly better PFS than the obinutuzumab-containing regimens. I mean, they're all equivalent at 3 years. And, you know, the question is about the long-term follow-up. Will the ven-obin-containing regimens have the same durability that we saw with FCR? And we don't know that yet.
Debbie, any comments on that and this idea of curative therapy? Are there situations where do you bring up FCR as an option? Do you recommend it in any situations? Again, of course, people think about it in younger patients.
I usually go over a pretty thorough explanation of all the different possibilities when I start somebody on therapy. And so FCR is included, but I would say I agree that there is this curative potential for the young patients. But when you start to see all the patients that have, you know, therapy-related MDS or AML and end up dying of their disease, and, you know, that is, it's just really striking and, you know, traumatizing, I guess. And so I would say probably in the last 7 years, I think I have given one patient FCR, and that was a young patient who had mutated IGHV and deletion 13Q, and she came in. She had read about FCR. She had read about the curative potential, and that was really what she wanted. I actually spent probably about 2 hours trying to convince her not to do it, and but that's what she wanted. So we did it, and she, you know, she did okay. Definitely a lot of toxicities, but she's still in remission, so it was a good choice for her.
Yeah, we actually had a patient, I forget the name of the trial, that compared FCR to, I think it was ibrutinib, who went on the trial in order to get ibrutinib, but then got randomized to FCR, which the patient didn't want, but took it anyhow, and, you know, appeared to be cured, you know, 10 years. So it was sort of an unintentional cure with FCR. Jennifer, what have we been learning about venetoclax, particularly in combination with anti-CD20? First of all, and one of the things that you brought out when we were talking about is the issue of dose of venetoclax and toxicity and whether or not you ever do dose reductions. Can you comment on what we know about that, Jennifer?
Right. So, you know, I think when you start running into cytopenias with venetoclax, there's often a tendency to potentially rush to dose reductions, but that's really not something that I do. I support the patients with growth factor aggressively if their ANC falls below 1,000. And I try to maintain the dose of venetoclax. This is mostly based on the phase one data, which it showed a significant difference in PFS for patients who had higher than 400 as a dose versus patients who were lower than 400. Interestingly, they have looked at venetoclax PK and CLL14 and did not really see an association of venetoclax exposure with toxicity, which I think is interesting. I have to say, in my experience, when I have ended up doing dose reductions, sometimes it helps, but a lot of times it doesn't, which is interesting and food for thought, perhaps.
Debbie, any thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think actually venetoclax is a very well-tolerated drug, especially when you're, you know, to the point where it's you're giving it on its own. And I probably have a little bit more people complain about nausea with it. And one thing that I think helps that is if you move the dosing to nighttime, then usually that nausea maybe just happens while they're asleep, or, you know, they could take a nausea pill before they go to sleep, and that usually clears it up. I also try to do pretty aggressive support with growth factors to prevent dose reduction with neutropenia. You know, occasionally I have, you know, like, for example, I have one patient that I just couldn't, I mean, she became profoundly cytopenic on, you know, and this was pancytopenia, on venetoclax. And I only got her through about three cycles with, you know, stopping and starting. And I ended up having to take her off of therapy, you know, when she got an infection. And just after that 3 months, and she's actually been in remission for probably 2.5 years without any evidence of CLL. And so I mean, I think some people are affected by it more than others, but I would say overall, it's just a really well-tolerated drug.
So Jennifer, you also, of course, updated us on what we know, what we learned this past year in terms of BTK inhibitors, including the 5-year data on the ELEVATE-TN study. Can you comment on that data and also specifically the issue of adding in anti-CD20, adding in obinutuzumab? Yeah, so we've seen this data. It really is looking like you definitely see a benefit by doing that. I'm curious what your thoughts are about it and how you deal with this clinically, Jennifer. Do you offer obinutuzumab to most of your patients starting acalabrutinib?
Yeah, so we have the 5-year update for the ELEVATE-TN study, which compared acala-obin to acala to obinutuzumab chlorambucil. You can see the curves here that there's actually a 12% improvement in the 5-year PFS with the addition of obinutuzumab. And that's associated with a higher complete remission rate, which I think is probably driving the difference in progression-free survival, even though we haven't traditionally thought that achieving a complete remission mattered that much with BTK inhibitors. So I do find these data convincing. As you know, it was not a planned analysis, but the curves have looked quite convincing from the beginning. They've been steadily separating over time, and 12% is a pretty significant difference. So I do offer obinutuzumab to patients when I offer them acalabrutinib. And some patients I'll push a little more towards it than others. If I would like to get a more rapid response, sometimes adding the obinutuzumab helps. Or if I'm more worried about them, then the additional 12% of PFS seems particularly helpful. What you find in clinical practice, though, is that many of the patients who are opting for a BTK inhibitor do not want to come in for antibody infusions, because they're picking the BTK inhibitor because it's easy and they don't have to have nearly as many visits as with the Ven-Obin. So a fair number of patients, especially the older patients, don't want to do the obinutuzumab. And, you know, I don't necessarily push them too much, but it depends on their exact situation and prognostic factors and how worried I am about them.
Any comments, Debbie? You know, these do look like a pretty significant difference there. Do you bring it up to your patients, particularly your younger patients and even older patients?
Yeah, I do bring it up, but I agree with a lot of the comments Jennifer's just made. I think one set of patients I almost always offer it are folks who are having, refractory autoimmune cytopenias, ITP, and autoimmune hemolytic anemia, because I think it kind of helps to jumpstart the responses you're going to get with the acalabrutinib. And, also sometimes it does take a while to work through the insurance hoops or getting free drug for acalabrutinib. And if they need treatment right away, you know, you have 3 weeks there where you're doing this lead-in with, obinutuzumab that you can still treat them while you're, gives you a little bit of time to get authorization. But I will say a lot of the patients who choose acalabrutinib are choosing it because you don't have to have infusions. And I haven't, fully worked it out in my mind yet if like that 12% difference in progression-free survival, is that worth, 8 trips to the infusion center, the cost of the obinutuzumab, the potential, infusion-related side effects, maybe a little bit more profound or prolonged neutropenia with it. And so I agree. I talk about it, but I don't generally push most patients to get the combination.
And of course, we are always talking about involving patients and family members in these difficult decisions. And this is certainly a very good example. Jennifer, another thing that you covered in your talk was the issue of acalabrutinib and PPIs, a problem that was, pretty significant. A lot of people, particularly in this country, are taking PPIs, and up until recently, that hasn't been possible if you're getting acalabrutinib. Can you talk about this tablet formulation, Jennifer, and is this basically going to become the way acalabrutinib's given?
Right. So, because of the limitation on acalabrutinib absorption in patients who are on PPIs and the need to stop it when you initiate therapy, AstraZeneca developed a different formulation, which is a tablet rather than the capsule. And that was launched in the U.S. around August of this year. And it is going to be the standard formulation now so that one won't have to worry about PPIs anymore. And they did publish the data looking at the equivalence of the tablet and the capsule, as shown here in the slide.
So certainly from a practical clinical point of view, this is really a great advance. But now let's get into the trickier question, which is zanubrutinib, currently not approved in CLL. You would expect that should be changing very soon. Jennifer, you talked initially in your talk about the trial comparing zanubrutinib to BR, the Sequoia study, showing, I guess one of the things there was really good outcomes in these 17P patients, almost 90% PFS at 2 years with 17P. How do you compare that to the data that's been seen, indirectly with the other BTK inhibitors, Jennifer?
Right. So it's a little hard because the follow-up is so much shorter, right? So with the ibrutinib, we have 6-year follow-up of the NHLBI study where there's a 61% PFS. And I do believe that the first report of that study was about 2 years and was around 80%. But, it's so hard to tell the different patient populations or to really compare across there that I don't really think we can so much. And acalabrutinib in the ELEVATE-TN has a 71-ish percent 5-year PFS in the 17P deleted patients. So those are really very good numbers also. And longer follow-up of this cohort, which is the largest dedicated cohort of patients with 17P deletion, actually much larger than the acalabrutinib or ibrutinib data sets, will be really helpful. And then, of course, the fact that in Alpine, we have head-to-head data where the benefit of Zanu compared to ibrutinib is particularly great in the 17P deleted patients. I think that's what I find the most compelling piece of information on the potential comparison.
Of course, we'll get into that in a second. But just getting back to you, Debbie, in terms of your current approach outside of a trial setting to first-line therapy with high risk, let's say 17P, most people lean towards BTK inhibitors. Are you doing that? And do you have a preference as to which one?
I definitely lean towards BTK inhibitors and 17P or TP53 deleted patients, just because, of course, not perfect cross-trial comparison to the CLL14 data, which was the frontline study with Venobin that Jennifer just reviewed a little bit earlier. It looks like the responses are a lot longer when using the BTK inhibitors, and whether that's just because it's continuous therapy, and would continuous venetoclax therapy be, you know, comparable? We don't really have that head-to-head data to understand it, but I generally will push people towards BTK inhibitors if they have a TP53 mutation. Right. I mean, I have been using acalabrutinib just because this is the approved combination, you know, the approved BTK inhibitor that's available right now. I think, you know, we just talked about the change in formulation of acalabrutinib. That makes it even better for acalabrutinib. I think that was timed nicely to come out before zanubrutinib got approved, because the canned answer when you choose between the two of them used to be, well, if they're on PPIs, which is, I don't know, maybe we should do an audience poll and see how many people are actually on PPIs, because it's a lot, I'm sure. But now that's not like a distinguishing factor. And, you know, there's not going to be a head-to-head trial between acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib. So, you know, do you extrapolate the data that, you know, says, you know, acalabrutinib and ibrutinib were the same in the Elevate treatment naives? Or the Elevate RR study, and then in the Alpine study, zanubrutinib was better than ibrutinib. So can we say that zanubrutinib is better than acalabrutinib? And I don't think we can really say that. I think it will still be a discussion with patients. I think it'll probably just come down to what people are familiar with. I mean, both acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib have excellent toxicity profiles. And so, you know, I think both of those drugs are really great options for the patients. It's, you know, a nice problem to have for CLL patients that we have so many good options available.
I feel like every day when we do CME programs, this issue comes up of indirect comparison. It's so common to have this, such a challenge. And with the, you know, just again, as the Alpine study comes in, also the data we just talked about with Acala, plus obinutuzumab, and you know how that indirectly would compare to, for example, what we see here in the Alpine study. So Jennifer, this is certainly the biggest CLL presentation at ASH, maybe one of the biggest ones of the year. We had seen data earlier last summer from EHA, the initial data that came out on the Alpine phase 3 study. Can you talk a little bit about the study itself and some of the key data points that you presented at ASH?
Sure. So Alpine was a phase 3 study in relapsed refractory CLL, SLL patients, all comers, as long as they'd had at least one prior systemic therapy and had measurable disease. And as it turns out, the patients had a median of one prior therapy. They were randomized between zanubrutinib and ibrutinib, as shown here, both continuous therapy. The randomization was stratified by age, geography, disease status, and 17P. And this is, and I should say the primary endpoint is overall response, which is what we heard a year and a half ago. But PFS was a key secondary endpoint for which most of the statistical power was actually saved. And so that was what we heard at this meeting, which is that with a median follow-up of 30 months, zanubrutinib was significantly superior to ibrutinib for PFS by a little over 12%, hazard ratio of 0.65. And then in the 17P group, it's 22% different at 2 years, at a landmark.
So maybe you can kind of, go ahead.
Yeah, so this is the first demonstrated efficacy benefit in a head-to-head comparison of BTK inhibitors. You heard Debbie earlier mention that in the head-to-head comparison of acalabrutinib versus ibrutinib, efficacy was non-inferior, so it was similar between the two. Although there was also a toxicity benefit in that study, as there was in this study. I already mentioned the degree of improvement was 12%, overall 22% in 17P. And zanubrutinib was also safer. There were fewer serious adverse events, fewer drug holds, fewer interruptions, and fewer discontinuations. And I thought the cardiac safety was particularly striking. There was only one discontinuation for a cardiac event with zanubrutinib versus 14 with ibrutinib. And there were no deaths, no cardiac deaths with zanubrutinib, but there were 6 with ibrutinib. Hypertension was about the same in the two arms, and we're not quite sure what to make of that, as it's a little bit higher in this study than it is in other Zanu studies. For example, in the Waldenstrom study, hypertension was lower than ibrutinib. So we'll see what happens with longer follow-up there.
So before I get Debbie's take on this, just kind of curious in terms of thinking about this drug or this BTK inhibitor versus other covalent BTK inhibitors. One of the things you mentioned this in your presentation at ASH, and when we did the recording, you got into a little more depth about sort of the pharmacology of zanubrutinib and the occupancy on the BTK receptor that you were kind of explaining to me. Can you kind of go into that a little bit and sort of what the difference is between zanubrutinib and the other covalent BTK?
Sure. So, you know, because they're covalent, they don't necessarily need to stay in the blood continuously to inhibit the target. So with ibrutinib and acalabrutinib, the target gets inhibited initially and the drug levels drop below the level required to inhibit BTK during the dosing interval. Zanubrutinib was deliberately designed to have a different pharmacokinetic profile where the level of the drug is maintained above the IC50 for inhibiting BTK throughout the dosing interval. So if BTK were to be resynthesized in the cell during the dosing interval, zanubrutinib could re-inhibit it. And that's not true of ibrutinib or acalabrutinib. And I would also note that the zanubrutinib dosing particularly optimized BTK even in lymph nodes, and the twice daily dosing optimizes that lymph node occupancy better than the daily dosing. And so it may be that the measured BTK occupancy is also better with zanubrutinib compared to acala. We don't have actually as much data or lymph node data with acala or ibrutinib as with zanubrutinib.
So, of course, you know, probably the practical key question here is zanubrutinib versus acalabrutinib. Jennifer, Debbie was referring to, you know, like last summer, particularly I heard this, the fact that, you know, the follow-up was shorter in the Alpine study. If you look at, again, in with all the caveats of indirect comparison, is similar time follow-up with acala versus zanu, you were, again, in our discussion, suggesting maybe there's not as big a difference as it appears at this point. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that? And I guess the other issue is how zanubrutinib would compare to acala / obin.
Right. So we did actually overlay the curves from ELEVATE-RR onto Alpine, and zanubrutinib is above all three of the other curves, and the ibrutinib curves are overlapping. I mean, this is an unholy analysis, right? But you know, in terms of what people have cited often about there being a PFS difference in ELEVATE-RR early that goes away, this is now 30-month follow-up, and the ELEVATE-RR follow-up is 38 months. So this is not that much shorter, and at this point, the difference in ELEVATE-RR had largely come together. So, you know, I think I agree that acala is a very good drug, and I'm still going to use acala, and I'm going to use zanubrutinib. These data, though, I think do represent a sort of higher level of data for Zanu than we've been fortunate to have with acala. And that does cause me to preferentially use it, you know, certainly in this relapse setting. And in the frontline setting, I'm also moving toward it preferentially, unless, so if the patient's willing to get open with acala, and I want them to have a more rapid response, that's kind of how I'm differentiating in the frontline setting right now, using the acala with obin, but zanu as a single agent. Some of this is also to get more experience with zanu, because even though I presented this trial, I still have significantly less zanu experience than I have with acala.
So a couple people in the chat room, Dilip is bringing up the issue of cardiac deaths, and you can see here your last bullet here. And this has been a problem, I think, is kind of coming into our consciousness more and more in the last couple years. certainly the horrible event that occurred in the big NFL football game earlier this week when a player had an arrhythmia in the middle of a football game has sensitized people to that. Jennifer, what do we know about cardiac deaths with zanubrutinib and acalabrutinib?
Right. So they seem to be significantly less than ibrutinib. We now know that across the entire ibrutinib experience, there's about a 1 to 1.5% rate of sudden cardiac death due to ventricular arrhythmias. Acalabrutinib, clinically, in my experience, has been much less. There is a report from Ohio State that just came out looking at ventricular arrhythmias, but also including PVCs, where they suggest that acala does have increased ventricular arrhythmia risk. I have to say I was not really convinced based on that data because a lot of the events were just PVCs and most of the patients stayed on drug without getting AICDs. So, and then zanubrutinib had, and I should say the other acalabrutinib experience also has not shown any significant signal for sudden death. And it's the same thing with zanubrutinib. We have not seen a significant signal for sudden death. And that's particularly dramatically observed in Alpine. So whether or not the ventricular arrhythmias are a class effect or not, I think is still a somewhat open question. But I do think we have enough data in terms of the overall experience to feel pretty safe saying that acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib are much safer than ibrutinib with respect to this problem.
So we'll see how this debate continues. We could spend a whole lot of time, and we will, I'm sure, over the next year and more on this question. But in not just the question of, you know, acala versus zanu or adding a bin, but now the next topic that Debbie got into with her talk, which is just combining venetoclax and BTK and whether or not how we factor that in to this discussion. So, Debbie, can you comment a little bit about some of the data we have? You went through the GLOW study and in terms of combining ibrutinib and venetoclax. What was your take on that?
The GLOW study is a pretty large phase 3 study, and it was specifically for older patients with treatment-naive CLL, so over the age of 65. And patients were either randomized to ibrutinib plus venetoclax, which there was a 3-month lead-in with ibrutinib before venetoclax was started, versus obinutuzumab and chlorambucil. That actual comparison of the two drugs is not very interesting, I think, because I don't think many people were convinced that obinutuzumab and chlorambucil would have a PFS benefit. But I think we did gain a lot of information about the combination with this study, and especially the combination when you use it in older patients. Because kind of the first studies that came out, like, for example, there's a study called the CAPTIVATE study, which is for younger patients that combine venetoclax and ibrutinib. And so this GLOW study really helped us to understand, you know, is there a different toxicity profile in older patients? One thing that One thing I really like about the combination is that it significantly reduces tumor lysis risk. When you add that, you know, do the ibrutinib for the 3 months, most people are not high risk for tumor lysis once you get to the venetoclax portion. And I think that's particularly useful for people who have really bulky disease that you're worried about, you know, just starting out blasting them with obinutuzumab, and the risk of tumor lysis even with obinutuzumab is fairly high in those patients. And so I like that. You know, the responses are great. I think we still just don't really understand, is it better to sequence these agents, like use ibrutinib until it stops working and then use venetoclax? Or is it better to use them all up front? You know, there's a lot more data coming out about retreatment with venetoclax or ibrutinib. You know, the CAPTIVATE study had a few patients that did relapse and they retreated them with single agent ibrutinib, and all of those patients had responses. And so I don't know. I think we're still stuck with a question. Is it better to, you know, blast people with our best treatments right up front? Do we need to save them because they're going to have a long lifespan and we haven't seen any, you know, real evidence of cure with any of these regimens. So we're still, I think in my experience, this combination is more toxic in the older population, especially with ibrutinib, just in terms of cardiac toxicities. And so, of course, there's a lot of studies looking at acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib combined with venetoclax, and maybe that would be better for the older patients in terms of toxicity. Where I like the combination right at this minute is for young patients with very bulky disease that I want to do a time-limited therapy, but I want some tumor lysis debulking before starting and, you know, to eliminate the need for using infusion appointments. I don't know yet because this regimen hasn't been approved in the U.S. It's a little bit atypical that things get approved in Europe before they get approved here, but this particular regimen did get approved in Europe already, and it's not yet here. So I am curious to figure out what are we going to do from a cost standpoint, from insurance, you know, the free drug assistance programs for both of them, you know, how is that going to work out logistically? I don't know yet. So I haven't used it outside of a clinical trial, but I do think it's a very interesting regimen.
So actually Debbie went through the FLAIR trial. You can check out her talk, another combination study. We talk about the idea of venetoclax consolidation as another way to sort of approach this. We mentioned acalabrutinib in the combination study. Here we have acalabrutinib, obinutuzumab, and venetoclax with really exciting outcomes. Jennifer, I've been kind of surprised. You know, we have a way of just saying, like, we might ask 5 investigators or 25 investigators, well, what would you like to do? Just put aside regulatory issues. And over this past year, I'm starting to see CLL people saying, if I could, I would give BTK plus venetoclax in some situations first line. Are there any situations right now, Debbie described one of the younger patient with bulky disease. I mean, you could debulk them with obinutuzumab as well. Any situations where you'd like to be using this combination right now, Jennifer?
You know, I'm not convinced. I do think it's an interesting combination, but I wouldn't use ibrutinib. So I'd have to get a second generation BTK with venetoclax. And it would be good to see the data on retreatment. I had reviewed and actually compared the reported 3-year progression-free survivals in both the older and younger patients for ven-obin versus ibrutinib-ven, and they're identical, actually really completely identical. And so if you give ven-obin, you're bringing in another drug. If you're maintaining the CD20 antibody, which we know was the first drug that had an overall survival benefit in the short term in the CLL randomized trial. So I've been sticking mostly to ven-obin because of that.
So, of course, the other issue is going to be, what do you do if you give them both and then they have disease progression? And that leads into the next topic, which is non-covalent BTK inhibitors. You covered, Debbie, and we saw more data at ASH on the one pirtobrutinib. Can you comment about this agent, what we know in terms of efficacy, also tolerability, Debbie?
Yeah, this agent is a really exciting agent and one to watch very closely because I think it's coming forward in a lot of different disease subtypes. Pirtobrutinib is a non-covalent BTK inhibitor, and so essentially it doesn't require that same binding site that all the other covalent inhibitors use, which is the C481 binding site, and that's the most common site that gets mutated and then leads to drug resistance. And so it's really great when you have a great class of drugs. You know, you can have somebody who's relapsed on ibrutinib or acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib, and they still have really incredible responses to pirtobrutinib. The study that was updated, it looked specifically at patients who had prior BTK inhibitors, and the overall response rate was 82% for people who had a prior BTK inhibitor. And, you know, the follow-up keeps getting longer and longer on this kind of monster phase 1 study with lots and lots of patients on it. But it still looks great. They have, they did some comparison at ASH this year about comparing PFS curves. If a patient had a C481S mutation versus wild type, there was no difference in the PFS curves there. It looked at people older versus younger than 75, no difference in those PFS curves. Deletion 70P and or TP53 mutated versus wild type, no difference there. So really, you know, pretty exciting and The progression-free survival is still a little bit short compared to what we hear in a lot of CLL studies. So, you know, we're really still talking about, you know, 19, you know, year and a half sort of time frame. But still, this is better than most things that we've seen. And what I think is very striking about this agent is the toxicity profile. It is really, really well tolerated. I mean, still have some of the bleeding issues. And of course, this drug hasn't been around as long as the other ones. And so there may be some longer term side effects that we just don't know about yet. But it's a really easy drug to give. It's pretty easy on patients. You know, I have many patients that have been on, you know, 12 prior therapies, and, you know, they've been beat up over the years, and they get on this drug and it really makes a difference to them. And so I think it's a game changing drug. We keep hearing that it's probably very close to being approved for mantle cell lymphoma. So once that is available on the market, it'll probably be easier for us to get it for other disease subtypes too.
So I don't know very much, even though I can certainly watch a lot in terms of what goes on with regulatory issues, the FDA, et cetera. I just know when there's a drug out there that a lot of people want to use, it's not available. And I would classify that in this situation, when you look at that waterfall plot where you see, you know, the same benefit in people who are resistant to covalent BTK inhibitors. Jennifer, what's your experience with pirtobrutinib? Where would you like to be using it right now, and how do you see it fitting in for the future?
Great. So we participated in the trial, and I would say that my experience actually mirrors the data from the trial quite well. It's very well tolerated, but patients who've progressed on prior BTK inhibitors tend to get a year, year and a half out of it, and then they develop resistance mutations. Now, that's still really good compared to what else we have to offer those patients, especially if they've already had venetoclax. When we did the trial, I actually used it often right after the BTK inhibitor and saved venetoclax for later. But one could use it also after BTK and BCL2 inhibitor. I would not use it in a patient who has not had a covalent BTK inhibitor, because there's still a lot that we need to learn about these mechanisms of resistance. And it's possible that resistance to pirtobrutinib could also lead to poorer response or poorer durability of a covalent BTK inhibitor. And we can't afford to risk that given how effective we know the covalent BTK inhibitors are.
Jennifer, what's your clinical experience with the non-cardiac toxicity, you know, arthralgias, skin issues, et cetera, with pirtobrutinib? And again, indirectly, how does it compare with, say, Ocala?
Non-existent with pirtobrutinib. You still certainly see arthralgias with Ocala. I haven't really seen much rash with Ocala. I think rash is primarily an ibrutinib effect, but you still see it a little. But with pirtobrutinib, you really see almost nothing in terms of side effects.
So Debbie, Jennifer referred to the issue of resistance to pirtobrutinib, and you commented on this in New England Journal paper looking at that. Can you comment on what we know about that at this point?
Yes, I will comment. And with the caveat, we don't have a lot of data yet. You know, this was a big New England Journal paper, but it only included 9 patients who developed resistance to pirtobrutinib. So there's probably still a lot that we don't understand yet. But of those 9 patients, 7 of them developed some sort of new BTK mutation. So, you know, with ibrutinib and zanubrutinib, acalabrutinib, we hear a lot about the C481S mutation because that's where it binds. But with this pirtobrutinib, there were a lot of different BTK mutations. So still a mutation in BTK, just different effects. And as Jennifer mentioned, one thing that they did also in this article is they compared, they had samples with all of these different BTK mutations, and they tested the efficacy with multiple different non-covalent and covalent BTK inhibitors. And the thing is that a lot of the resistance mutations seen in patients with pirtobrutinib would make the patient resistant to all the covalent inhibitors. However, the, you know, C481S, which is the most common seen with the covalent, doesn't make you resistant to pirtobrutinib. And so again, this is a little bit of a sequencing question. And so far we haven't cured CLL with these agents. And so I think we still have to consider sequencing. And so I too am a little bit cautious about the thought of using pirtobrutinib right up front, because I think we burn the whole BTK inhibitor class once that stops working.
So Jennifer, I see there's a number of non-covalent BTK in addition to pirtobrutinib. Any of them with sort of theoretical advantages over pirtobrutinib, or even clinical data suggesting advantages?
Well, nintobrutinib is the other one that has evidence of good efficacy, and we had an update on that at ASH. It has about a 65% response rate, and durability, we don't have the same follow-up yet as pirtobrutinib, but there's some suggestion that at least some of the responses will be durable. It does have more toxicity than pirtobrutinib, though. It does actually have a broader kinase inhibition profile. It has some activity against MEK, for example, and some of these other activities that nintobrutinib may have could actually perhaps enhance activity in the very relapsed refractory setting. But we don't really have enough data to evaluate that yet. And if the toxicity is a problem, then that could obviously limit anything that we might see there. The other two, vecabrutinib has been discontinued based on not having sufficient efficacy in heavily pretreated patients, and fenebrutinib moved toward development in autoimmune disease.
So another topic that you covered in your talk, Debbie, was CAR T therapy. You know, that was the first, CLL was the first thing, I think one of the first things we heard about with CAR T. And then I guess, you know, all the novel agents, venetoclax, BTK came out. And I'm not sure if that was the reason we started to see, you know, less data on CAR T because people were doing so well, but it is a very effective therapy. Can you comment on what we know right now in terms of lysocaptagene from the TRANSCEND study?
Yeah, this is a really effective therapy, and it, you know, works in a completely different mechanism of action than all of our other agents, because you're really trying to use the patient's own immune system to fight the CLL, which is particularly important in CLL because, you know, T cells are pretty dysfunctional just baseline when you have CLL. And so, you know, by extracting them and helping to train them to go after the CD19 positive cells is what lysocell is trying to do. You know, it is really effective. This TRANSCEND study we participated in, it was great because these people who had many, many prior therapies, including both BTK inhibitors and BCL2 inhibitors, had great overall response rates, 82%, and a 46% CR rate, which is, you know, different than what you see with most of the targeted kinase inhibitors. You know, it's kind of smaller patient groups, but the difference between people who had prior BTK and BCL2 was the same as people who didn't have both of those prior. So this heavily pretreated group did just as well as the other groups. Lysocell is pretty, in terms of comparison to other CAR Ts, has a little bit less toxicity. So cytokine release, even though seen in about 3/4 of patients, majority of those were low grade, does have some neurotoxicity. And, you know, we're talking about kind of this big, you know, event like a transplant that patients have to go through. They collect their cells, they get chemo, they get this agent, may have these cytokine release or neurotoxicity that requires them to be hospitalized afterwards. And really, again, completely a cross-trial comparison, but the progression-free survival is very similar, about a year and a half, to what we see with pirtobrutinib in this setting. And so, you know, pirtobrutinib is just so much less toxic. And given the patient population that has CLL, you know, typically older with medical comorbidities, you know, is it worth the added toxicity to do this? And that's where I think, you know, it may even make more sense in CLL just because the T cells don't work great to start with. Maybe the allogeneic CAR Ts might be a better in this patient population, but, you know, more to come on that. I think it just still shows, you know, this refractory to BTK and BCL2 is still an area of need. And, you know, there's still the question, you know, we see these great responses, but the duration isn't as long as we would like to see given, you know, the upfront toxicity of the regimen. And so, you know, there's always a question, should this be used as a bridge to something else? Or is this the end, you know, end treatment, then just move on to something else when patients relapse? I think, you know, Jennifer, it can't be, you know, can't forget that this really depletes normal B cells. So these patients have issues with hypogammaglobulinemia long term. And most of my patients who have had CAR T are on IVIG replacements, which of course is a monthly infusion. So still, you know, kind of requiring some therapy.
Jennifer, what's your take on CAR T? And also Hassan in the chat room wants to know about bispecifics in CLL.
Right. So, you know, I agree with what Debbie said about CAR T. We do have high response rates, but I was really pretty disappointed in the progression-free survival for something that requires so much effort and upfront toxicity. That being said, a lot of it is certainly due to the immune dysfunction of CLL and the problems with the T cells. And so, you know, people are working hard on that, and hopefully some progress can be made. There's evidence that using BTK inhibitors together with CAR T may improve some of the expansion of the T cells and potentially improve responses, but we still need a lot more data on that. And bispecifics, I think everyone's very excited about the potential for bispecifics in CLL, but the data are still pretty limited. Epcoritamab has data that has been presented with CLL, but most of the other drugs don't yet. And I'm hoping that that will change soon.
So, yeah, maybe it might change related to this next topic, which to me was, I don't know, maybe I'm overly optimistic, but, you know, Richter's is such a terrible problem. I was very excited. Pirtobrutinib and Richter's. Debbie, can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think everyone was pretty excited about this. These data, which were updated at ASH, about there were 82 patients on this Bruin study with pirtobrutinib, and 82 is a very large number of patients with Richter's transformation on studies. I mean, when you look back at most of the classic studies that guide our treatment, there we're talking about 20, 25, 30 patients on study. So this is a big study. They had a lot of prior treatment. You know, a third of them had prior BTK, prior BCL2 inhibitors, and even some patients had prior CAR T cell therapy. So, you know, there was a 52% overall response rate. What I think is a little bit exciting is that there was a 13% complete response rate, which is, you know, I would say pretty impressive for a targeted kinase inhibitor. But we are still stuck with the duration of response being quite short. So, you know, we're still talking about 6 months duration of response. These patients on study did have a overall survival of about 13 months, which is longer than what we expect, you know, with most of our standard therapies. I mean, I usually counsel patients when they're diagnosed that the expected median survival is still 6 to 9 months. And so definitely looks like there have been an impact on survival in these patients, but they're still short. You know, one of the things that was great is 6 of the patients on the study were able to proceed on to a curative intent allogeneic stem cell transplant. So, you know, maybe it's good to, you know, maybe we need a combination to make the duration a little bit longer. Maybe we should be using it as a bridge to more definitive therapy. But all in all, you know, any active agents in Richter's are needed. And so these were pretty exciting data.
So, Jennifer, I tend to think about things in a very simple macro point of view. When I think about, you know, Richter's, I think about diffuse large B-cell. When I think about diffuse large B-cell, I don't think too much about BTK. So, first of all, has pirtobrutinib even been looked at in diffuse large B-cell? And what do we know in general about BTK inhibitors and Richter's, Jennifer?
So, You know, Richter's, I think, is fundamentally different than de novo diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Biologically, it really does seem to be different in terms of the mutations and the biology. And I've actually had some of my better luck in Richter's using the targeted inhibitors that we use for CLL and sometimes using BTK and venetoclax in combination. And there are reports of ibrutinib, for example, case reports leading to, you know, some duration of remission. Acalabrutinib was formally studied, had about a 40% response rate. Same kind of durability we're seeing here with pirtobrutinib, actually, though, the 4 months. And, you know, that tends to be the problem with Richter's. You can often get a response to your first couple of therapies, but then people relapse quickly. And so that durability, to me, is really the holy grail. And that's what we need to really look out for. I do agree that the complete response rate, though, here is very interesting, and that if those are more durable, that would give it a leg up over some of the other agents. You know, I'm actually not sure if pirtobrutinib has looked at diffuse large B-cell lymphoma separate from Richter's. There were about 12 cohorts in that phase one, and I'm trying to remember if there was a cohort for DLBCL. If there was, it was only not a lot of patients, and I don't think it's been reported yet.
So final piece of data that or paper that Debbie talked about, we were talking about bispecifics and EBCO. So EBCO and Richter's, Debbie, looks like it has some activity. What do you, can you comment?
Yeah, this was also pretty exciting. And although admittedly very short, short follow-up and a small number of patients. So this is only 10 patients that were presented. But, you know, anything that has activity in Richter's is exciting enough to warrant presentation. But what was really great about this is 50% had a complete response. So, you know, 5 out of 10 did have a complete response. This has a good toxicity profile with lower grade CRS as when compared to like a CAR T. But I think very notably missing from the presentation at ASH was the duration of response. And as Jennifer just mentioned, I think durability of response is really important for this subgroup, and it wasn't mentioned at all. So I think longer follow-up will tell us how durable it is. But, you know, maybe if this could be used as a bridge to a transplant or, you know, something like that, if you can get them into a quick complete remission and then get them onto a more definitive therapy, I think, you know, there's real promise when you see response rates like that for patients with Richter's.
So speaking of bispecifics, come on back next Tuesday for our year review program, multiple myeloma. We've got a bispecifics just approved, teclistamab, in the last couple months. We'll talk about the determination trial as well from the ASCO meeting. Jennifer and Debbie, thank you so much participating in this program. Audience, thank you for attending. Check out their presentations. Come on back next Tuesday for multiple myeloma. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Debbie. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you.